At that time, what was I except a kid with nothing? I had no car, and I still slept on a bunk bed in a second-floor apartment in Garfield, New Jersey. Garfield. Even the name of the town made me sound like a loser. I couldn't pull up stakes and move to a more prestigious address, couldn't suddenly materialize a driver license and a car. I had to work with what I had. I took up smoking Marlboros, figuring that looking cool was worth the risk to my health. Making a catalog of all my pluses and minuses, I came up with precious few of the first and a lot more of the latter. I realized that on the plus side, I didn't possess much more than ambition and intellect. But even back then, I grasped a simple fact of life, that there was nothing more sexy to a woman than a man with talent and ambition. If you also had a brain attached to that combination, and with me the jury was still out in that respect, you were golden. I was still determined to move my relationship with Lila from the digital to the physical, from AIM to something real. We never danced, or rather, Lila and I never partnered, never entered competitions as a couple. She danced competitively with a kid who was 18. At that point, I was dancing up an age level, competing with 15 or 16-year-olds. Not only were Lila and her partner older, they were better dancers than me and my partner. I continually felt defeated and deflated. All my poetry, all our online messaging amounted to nothing. Whatever we had together, whatever it was still secret, intimidating, and impossible. "Lila is totally out of your reach," whispered a small interior voice, a voice of failure. We had started talking in November 2000, and it wasn't talking, really, just online communicating. And a month later, we ended up at the same New Year's Eve party. I had heard through the grapevine that Lila was going to be there, and though the obstacles against me seemed insurmountable, I vowed that I would somehow make it to that party. But I was stuck in a New Year's celebration with my parents, which was a tradition in our family. I had to beg my brother for help. "You've got to get me out of this party and into the party in Brooklyn," I told Max. "Please, tell the parental unit some shit. Anything. Vouch for me, bro. Tell them it'll be all right for me to do this." Not for the first time, and not for the last, Max came through for me. He finagled permission from our mom and dad, then drove me to Brooklyn and dropped me off at the party. I was ecstatic. That first taste of adulthood was the sweetest thing ever. First, I was drinking. And second, I was smoking cigarettes. For the wunderkind from Garfield, New Jersey, who always did what he was told, it was heaven. I knew everybody there, but they were older. So underneath my surface bravado, I knew I was bluffing. Nothing happened between Lila and me. Being together at that party represented only the most limited kind of interaction, because Lila seemed to be caught inside this cloud of insane sexual energy. Other dudes constantly buzzed around her. She was the sun, and I was like the moon, with no light of my own except what little reflected off her, constantly eclipsed by the shadows of all her male friends. That night left me heartbroken. What had I expected? Some sort of reverse Cinderella tale where I was magically transformed into a prince? Instead, I was like, damn, is that all there was? Then the next day, she reached out again. As far as I could understand, through the medium of instant messenger, she was in love with me, just as much as I was in love with her. I sent flowers to her on Valentine's Day. In late February, I cut school and we met at Battery Park in Lower Manhattan. It was so wintry that the whole city seemed frozen solid. The wind knifed in off the harbor as we took a walk in the chilling-ass cold. Purely as a matter of survival, I thought our only option was to get as close as two humans could possibly get. Oh, it was one of those slow-motion, young love moments where we beat around the bush for a second and then just jump into each other's hearts with the greatest taste of joy I think that I had ever felt up until that point. We made out, and that was it. That was when we swore our love, right then and there, among the shrieking seagulls. From that point forward, we might have been technically and officially dating, but I still lived in Garfield and was still too busy studying ballroom and violin. I didn't talk to anyone about this monumental development in my life, except, of course, for telling my boys that they had lost the bet and they had to pay up. Lilia and I developed a kind of long-distance, interstate, greater New York metropolitan area, Brooklyn to New Jersey relationship. 2 months later, I ended up losing my virginity to her. Forgetting that Lilia herself was also very young, just 16, I had this whole mistaken notion that she was somehow very experienced in the ways of love. I was just a kid, while she had grown men looking at her, but she was in love with me and didn't want anybody but me, because, as I said, there was nothing sexier than talent and ambition, with a little bit of intellect thrown in. Ah, fuck yeah. That spring I turned 15 and she turned 17. I wanted to be older for her, more mature, more experienced. I asked myself, where are the notches on my belt? I thought I had to have a bunch of notches, a bunch of sexual conquests, so Lila would see me as fully grown up. I played around and I lost her. It was my first lust, my first love, and I was devastated when it ended. My GPA took a further nosedive, I didn't get enough sleep, and I no longer gave a fuck about dance, the violin, or anything but her. I wrote agonizing poems on the subject of lost love. I was Yevgeny Onyegin, the title character in Pushkin's novel who writes a poem to the love of his life before going out and dying in a duel. For sure it changed me, being introduced to that type of heavy emotional involvement. I returned to high school as a sadder but wiser man of the world, saving the money I was making teaching dance and performing with Max at Brighton Beach nightclubs. I took a train into Manhattan and bought Lila a ring. Not an engagement ring or anything like that, but I just wanted to give her jewelry, being maybe a little unclear on the concept that you should give a ring to mark the start of a relationship rather than its end. Lila stood at the beginning of my life as a romantic adult, and sex and lust have woven themselves through my days forever afterward. I want to recount the story of another time when sexual attraction changed the course of my life, but it might take some telling before the lust element finally enters, coming in from off stage at an entirely unexpected time. In 2003, just before Max was first recruited for Dancing with the Stars, I hit a period where I wanted to dance but didn't want to compete. My girlfriend and new dance partner Sandra Yudis and I had just won the Youth World Latin Dance Championship, one age level up from the Junior Worlds I had won in 2001 with Dina. I was ready for a break from the rigors of training, so we developed a two-couple tour, me with Sandy and my brother matched with Yelena, a brilliant Moscow-born dancer who had been his partner since the previous year. Sandra, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed stunner, looked like a Barbie doll next to me as Ken. I was really passionate about us as a couple and felt that we had complementary forms of energy, a well-put-together woman and a man with an overtly masculine look. Sandy was the all-American girl and I was the exotic import. At one of our shows, after we finished our fourth dance and before starting our last one, I had to perform a quick costume change, so my brother took the mic to say a few words. People who know my brother know that in his hands, a microphone can suddenly transform into a grenade. He had the ability, some might say disability, to pronounce the most ordinary, most politically correct words in ways that never seemed to come out as he intended. I don't know how to explain it, but in the ballroom world, the way girls spoke about competition was very different from how boys talked. Whenever people got into a conversation about results, girls used identifying markers that were always from the costumes. Who came in fourth? Oh, it was the girl in the yellow dress. Oh yeah, what about third? Oh, you know, the girl with the slick back hair and the pink vested dress. I saw it all the time, and that's just how the chatter went. But among boys, the way to list results was merely to mention the first name of the male of the couple. Max was second, Joe was third, Mike was fourth, Tommy and Jackie were fifth, and you know, Anthony from Ohio, yeah, he was sixth. It was assumed that the guys were talking about both members of the couple. They weren't trying to disrespect anybody, just keeping the conversation moving. This was just the insolence of the game and how competition results were described. But Max made the mistake of using that inside ballroom language in public. "It's a very special moment for our family," he announced to the audience as I was backstage switching costumes. "Since we're here, and all our friends and family are here, I wanted to share something very special that happened last week. Val won Worlds." The room blew up with applause, so even if Max wanted to go on, he wouldn't have been heard. He could have continued and said, "Obviously my brother couldn't do it without Sandra Udis, and the whole Udis family was incredible." But for a long moment, he couldn't say anything. He had to wait for all the applause to finish. In that interval, Sandy's mother had just enough time to get infuriated. She was a woman of status in Brooklyn, a person of large personality and larger ambitions. If there is ever such a thing as Real Housewives of Brighton Beach, which is not a bad idea, she could be the star of the show. Her husband was also a powerful man locally. The whole family, Sandy included, was for better or worse very much a product of the Brighton Beach social hierarchy. To add insult to injury, Sandy's mother had a good friend stand by her side that night, and this friend leaned over to rub a little salt in the wound. "So, this Val person, he won the competition all by himself?" Because of that acid-tongued friend, what would have been a simple gaffe by my brother turned personal. Even though none of this should have been about a stage parent in the first place, Sandy's mother seemed embarrassed because the friend she'd brought along had now witnessed the incident. What could I say? We, not just I, had indeed just won the Worlds. A year and a half prior to that, Sandy had been ranked 6th in the United States. After our championship at the youth level, she rose to be ranked 1st in the world, due to her talent, of course, but also to my brother's coaching and what we were able to accomplish together, the three of us. My father's old 99% was due to the parents' rule came into play again. Right away, I realized that Max had fucked up. So while Sandy was still backstage, I rushed out and finished changing on the floor, managing to smoothly snatch the mic away from my brother. "You know, hey guys, yes, Sandy and I won," I said. "I just want to give a special thanks to our parents." I gestured vaguely in the direction of my partner's mom, who still had steam coming out of her ears. "Sandy and I would have never been able to accomplish what we did without our incredible parents. Please give it up for Sandy's parents and my parents." I tried to remedy the situation as much as I could, but the damage had been done and there was no going back. I turned to Sandy. "Are you cool?" "Are you kidding me?" she responded. "I don't give a fuck." She knew that this was a simple slip of the tongue, which was very common for my brother, and he obviously didn't mean anything by it. Sandy's mom really lit into my father, who kept his tone very polite, apologizing again and again. But after saying "I'm very sorry" a few times, an edge crept into his voice. "We just took your daughter and we made her into a world champion," he said, quoting the facts from his perspective. "We did that for your daughter and with your daughter. All you had to do was write the check and show up at the airport, and now you're giving us a hard time." The woman would not leave it alone. She called the next day to harangue my father some more. "What do you want me to do?" my dad asked, becoming exasperated. "Do you want me to apologize 100 times? Max made a fucking mistake. He apologized for it. Let's move on, you know?" She didn't want to move on, and finally my father had had enough. "Is this about Sandy being offended, or is it about you being humiliated because your stupid friend was talking shit?" Sandy's mom reported the incident to a friend who apparently told someone else, who then called and threatened my father. This guy, I don't know how else I can put it without getting in trouble with the libel lawyers, but he was the type, like, maybe you didn't want to ask too many questions about his business. Now we were getting death threats for a silly mistake behind the microphone. My brother overheard the menacing conversation, and while he and my father would normally never share something like that with me, when we hit our bunk beds that night, the truth came out. "Yo, somebody called Pops and was threatening him," he said. "What? Over the Sandy thing?" I couldn't believe it, man. I leaped out of bed and paced the floor. "Okay," I muttered, more to myself than to Max. "Okay, we're done." "What do you mean?" Max asked. "Who's done?" "Sandy and I," I said. "We're finished." In a split second, my reality shifted. This wasn't a girl that I just danced with. Sandy and I were dating, too. but with zero hesitation, I decided on the spot that she and I were over. As far as I was concerned, Sandy's mom preoccupied herself with stroking her own ego instead of supporting and celebrating her daughter. In my view, as a parent, she didn't deserve to have the trophy in her household. She didn't deserve the accolades, and most of all, didn't deserve our effort. The next day I headed out to Brooklyn. My parents counseled against any rash moves. "Are you sure?" "Don't worry about us. We're fine. You don't have to split with Sandy just for us." "Dad, are you kidding me?" I said, getting up on my teenage high horse. "I am doing it for you. I'm not going to coexist with somebody who's willing to put your life in danger." "Keep it moving," I told myself, "always and forever." I met up with Sandy, and telling her we were breaking up was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I remember we were in Brighton Beach outside of her luxury apartment building. I had come out with two of my friends, Eugene and Andre. They waited across the street just kind of looking out because there were really scary people in the Russian immigrant community of Brighton Beach. I felt as though I had to have some backup. "Listen, Sandy, I love you," I said, one eye on my boys and the other on the front door of her house, in case her father charged out. "I would never want to make you feel bad, and I know you still have to listen to your parents, but the truth is I just can't deal with your mom anymore. It's not right, and I know it may not be fair to you." Then I shrugged my shoulders and pronounced the phrase just then coming into vogue, "But it is what it is." Though Sandy told me she understood, I might have broken her heart right there. She was kind, sweet, and vulnerable, but strong in her own way, and she actually might have saved a life afterward, because a little birdie informed me that even though emotions still ran high in Brighton Beach against the upstart Schmikowski family, Sandy insisted to her parents that nothing bad should happen to me. "I'll run away and never talk to you guys ever again," she warned them. At least to her, the situation seemed just that serious, just that intense. After things settled down somewhat, Sandy's mom called me to plead for her daughter's reinstatement as my partner. "Come on," she said, "you know I was just joking and that nothing was ever going to happen." "I'm sorry," I said, a little man who was trying to man up. "It's over." Like a lot of people who put their foot down, I didn't think about what was going to happen afterward. Having just won the Youth Worlds with Sandy, I was at the peak of my competitive career. Except now, I no longer had a partner. Blackpool was coming up, and skipping it wasn't an option. I had to find another person to dance with, and I had to do it quickly. Julianne Hough, one of the best dancers in the world at my age level, might have been a candidate if she hadn't quit competing a year before to concentrate on a potential music career. Even though Julianne was currently and famously saying no to ballroom, I still felt there might be a little wiggle room, and maybe I could reach out and convince her to partner with me. Julianne and her longtime partner Mark Ballas were awesome and incredible, and she had quit kind of suddenly. I had a hunch that you don't break it off at age 17 with someone like Mark and then never dance again. That's just not the way things happen. Ballroom was like the mob. The only way out was in a casket. So Julianne was on my radar as someone to fill the void left by Sandy. A whole day had already passed, and I didn't really have a moment to waste. I turned to my most trusted ally. "Hey, Max," I said, "what do you think? I want to dance with Julianne." "Yeah, great," he said. "Only maybe you forgot, but Julianne's not dancing anymore. Maybe she will for me. Let's reach out and see what happens." It didn't take long for me to find her number. In the meantime, I had all these local girls, great dancers who were ranked second in America or third, fifth, whatever. They were hitting me up for a chance to be my partner. I didn't pay anybody apart from Julianne any mind. Why beat around the bush when I knew exactly what I wanted? In situations like these, one thing that was popular in the ballroom world was holding tryouts. The candidates and I would perform some basic steps, do some choreography together, and then maybe have a coach come in to judge if we were aesthetically a compatible fit, if we harmonized, if we looked good together. I found the whole business loathsome and humiliating for the girl. I didn't like it. And maybe I was wrong. Maybe I was overanalyzing, which I always did and always do. Every time I split up with a partner, the situation already had reached the level of the catastrophic so that it was a very painful process, literally, like a divorce. After splitting with Sandy, I was feeling cored out and emotionally exhausted. How was I going to go through yet another heartbreak? And who the fuck did I think I was to have one girl after another come in and try out, only to have them hear, "No, sorry, next." These were people's lives I was dealing with. Who was I, the fucking bachelor? As far as ballroom couples went, I believed in arranged marriages. Find the person that you want, get in the room together and say, "Hey, are you into doing this?" To me, love was always a verb. Love just didn't magically happen. I had to make it happen. No angel would descend from heaven and present herself as my perfect partner. My job was making the perfect couple, to find a way to love that person, cherish her, and help her shine. With Sandy, that had been the case too. She wasn't on my level when we started, but she inspired me, and that was enough. Our mutual effort took care of the rest, and we worked and worked until she was the number one dancer in her age group. "I'm not going out there, you know, trying out girls like I'm shopping for shoes," I told Max, tearing into a rant. "I know what I want. I want to dance with Julianne. No offense to anybody, but I don't want to fucking hear from anyone else. I don't want to waste my time. I don't want to waste their time. And I don't want to get their hopes up and then shut them down." "Well, maybe you should talk to..." he began. "No, I don't care. I want to dance with her. I don't care that she quit. I don't care about anything. We're reaching out and we're dancing with Julianne. Boom, that's it." "Okay, okay," Max said, accustomed to seeing me go off in that manner. I finally called Julianne. "Hey, it's Val." Everyone knew everyone in the small world of competitive ballroom, so I didn't have to give more than my first name. "Oh, hi. Wow. My God, how are you?" "You know, I have no idea what you're doing right now," I said. "I don't know where you are with dance and everything, but I'd love to compete with you. I'd love to dance with you." "You know, Val, I haven't competed in some time, and to be honest, I'm pursuing my music right now. I'm in LA and actually finishing up an album." We went back and forth a few times, but Julianne wouldn't budge. She was out of the world of ballroom competition. I was disappointed, but tried to put the best face on it. "All right, cool," I mumbled half-heartedly. "Well, you know, it was worth a try. Good luck out there. Keep on killing it. And thanks for taking the call." I added one more "cool" for flavor and hung up. That was on a Thursday. On Friday, I got a call back from Julianne. "I've reconsidered and, you know, for the last 8 months, I've been thinking about ballroom a lot. I definitely miss dancing and miss competing. And to be honest, all those times I was thinking about it, the only person I could ever see myself coming back to competition with was you." Oh man, I was overjoyed. "Whoa, holy shit, that's awesome. The only thing is I might need a couple of days before I could fly out," Julianne said. "I could probably be in Jersey by Monday." It was coming up on the weekend, so I told her Monday would be fine. Suddenly, the recent events in my life made sense. Thanks, Max. Thanks for taking that microphone and almost getting our father killed and busting up my partnership with Sandy. Because now, I was going to dance with the one woman in the world who represented everything I wanted in a partner. Or so I thought. Throughout this period, my father and brother were getting bombarded with calls from John Kimmins, president of the World Federation of Ballroom Dancers, the umbrella organization for ballroom dance in America. "Val absolutely has to do a tryout with Lera," John said. He meant Valeria Kozarinova, whom everyone called Lera. Here we are, back in the world of Russian nicknames. I knew Lera. I had actually considered taking her on as a partner before I went with Sandy. I had a little crush on Sandy at the time, and though I knew this girl Valeria was awesome, I'd heard little hints that she could also be very shall we say, dramatic. Back then, I had a friend who danced with her. When we hung out, I would see him getting constant texts from Lera. Where are you? Who are you with? Calling, texting, reaching out. Man, she seems like a lot, I remember commenting at the time. So I went with Sandy and never regretted it. Now, I tried to politely put off Mr. Kimmins, sending the message that I had already settled on a partner. There was another side of the triangle. Julianne's brother, Derek, at that time had recently split with his partner, too, and was seriously seeking to dance with Lera. Kimmins would not take no for an answer. You gotta have Val take a trial with Valeria, he told both my parents and my brother during multiple calls over the course of the weekend. Listen, he doesn't want to have tryouts, Max told Kimmins. He's not interested in tryouts, doesn't like them, doesn't want them. We have our minds set on somebody, and it isn't Lera. But Max was working on the other side of the fence, too, trying to convince me. Look, he said, this guy just keeps calling. You don't want to piss off the president of the Dance Federation, do you? I had recently lost a competition at Blackpool, England, taken second by one mark. No pun intended. I lost to Mark Ballas. Among the 13 adjudicators that day had been John Kimmins, and he had cast a tie-breaking ballot in the finals. Going in, I had been ecstatic because it was the first time I had seen an American judge at Blackpool, because in the past, the judging panel was comprised solely of old British farts who made Len Goodman look like Brad Pitt in his prime. I thought I would have politics working in my favor for once, but Kimmins consistently marked me a second, and his mark was the deciding factor. If he would have given me one first place, not five, just one, in a single one of the dances, I would have taken first at Blackpool. I never placed the blame on him, because I should have never have let it get that close. But you expect support from the people who represent the same flag as you. Maybe to him I was just some Russian kid from Brooklyn. Half a year later, I wasn't exactly holding a grudge, because everything happens for a reason, right? But I shut down Kimmins when I talked to Max. I'm not going to listen to that dude, I said to my brother. I don't give a fuck about who's president of anything. It's not like these guys do me any favors anyway. We've always been free agents. We've been doing our own thing and it's worked out fine. We're Monaco and he's France. You know what I'm saying? Max did know what I was saying, but he insisted I see Lera. So that Saturday, fresh of committing to a partnership with Julianne Hough the day before, I found myself in Rising Star's studio waiting for a woman I knew for certain I was going to turn down. I remember I had all my boys there because they were all teaching or practicing, but also because once again I felt as though I needed backup. In came Valeria. This chick was a fucking character. First of all, her presence. She was sexy and dark-haired, with huge eyes and long legs. She looked like a Bond girl, maybe in From Russia with Love, only this was more like From Russia with Lust. She was the polar opposite of Julianne. I felt it instantly. Julianne was the girl next door, a Disney heroine, or maybe Jennifer Aniston, while here was Angelina Jolie, straight up. Lera had presence, an exotic kind of crazy energy. She was unconventional and clearly over the top, but in the most striking, most incredible, most Greek goddess way possible. She might have acted a little insane, but was insanely beautiful because of it. As soon as I saw her, my inner voice started mumbling, shit, 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 knowing that she was going to upend the apple cart. But I played it cool. Hi, how are you? Хорошо, все нормально, using Russian to answer, all right, which was to me so extra, since she had lived in the States for years by this time. But like I said before, she was a character. She vaulted off to the changing room, and I looked over at my guys. Their eyes followed her out like she was the sexiest thing they had ever seen. She came back flustered and all over the place. I was reminded again why I didn't like tryouts, because of the stress they placed on the other person and on myself. As she headed onto the dance floor, Her shoe strap broke. I immediately took it for an omen. Okay, God, thank you for the sign. Got you. Good. The decision was going to be easy then. But Lera had brought along another pair of shoes. She was wearing a dress designed by Espen Salberg, who was an ex-dancer, now a legendary coach and teacher. If there was a Mount Rushmore of ballroom dance, Salberg would be right up there. Like any ambitious, restless artist, he was eager to branch out. He got into dance fashion and then started making dresses. His style was totally, aggressively off the hook. Lera wore that black Salberg dress as though she had been born in it, and she didn't bother with a bra either. Everything about her was on a higher level of maturity than I was currently enjoying. I was just coming off a competition that was open to everyone under 18, and I was a fucking child compared to this woman. The male brain tends to become a little oxygen starved at such moments, since all the blood is rushing to another part of the body. Holy shit, was about the only kind of thought I could entertain. She is so hot. My brother stood by the music machine. I had my crew lined up and sitting against the wall, Kiki, Cole, Serge, Eugene, and Teddy, all of them. Lera, her nipples hard and poking through the dress, warmed up her long-ass legs doing her rumble walks, exhibiting a physical confidence that filled the room. Thank God the boys were all sitting down, because otherwise it would have been a little embarrassing for everybody. Lera and I started dancing together, and we literally did two basic steps before I was seduced. I was seduced not only by her physical self, but by her energy. She had a different air about her, a subtle quality of movement that wasn't so much athletic as artistic. Again, the way she moved rose to a whole other level of maturity. She was a woman, not just a talented girl. For the first time in my life, I felt as though I was dancing with an adult. I understood that in any partnership with Lera, there would be a huge potential for me to grow, because I would have to step up and become a man in order to complement this woman, just to be able to stand next to her. That was it. She won me over. The challenge of it enticed me. I decided I wanted to dance with Lera, starting right at that moment and continuing into the foreseeable future. We did five steps and an overturn. The thin fabric of her dress moved with her. There was a minor wardrobe malfunction, and we stopped abruptly. "Hey, let me go change," she said. "Yeah, you should probably do that," I said, practically choking on the words. She left the room, and I turned around, and all my boys were sitting there with their mouths open and their thumbs up. I looked over at my brother. "Max, what do you think?" "Bro, I've never seen you able to create this kind of image before. This is the shit that you're a fan of. When we watch and we like who we watch, this is what we like." I was sold. Lera and I finished the tryout and said our goodbyes. "Okay, well, see you later," she said, letting the question trail off. Yeah, we'll give you a call," I said, feeling foolish. "Okay, ladna, хорошо," she said. "Okay, cool," giving me a slight kiss on the cheek as she left. My brother and I drove home, and I had one word to say to him. Блядь! That was a curse word in Russian, one of the most common expressions from Moscow to Odessa and beyond. The literal definition was whore or bitch, but it was a tofu word, taking on the flavor of the context around it. So it could just as well mean shit, fuck, or wow, depending on the speaker's intention. "What are we gonna do?" I wailed to Max. "Blats, blats, blats, we had this whole plan. It's Saturday, and we've got Julianne flying in on Monday. What the fuck are we gonna do?" "Bro," Max said, all sober-like since it wasn't his problem. "It is what it is. What do you want to do? Do you want to dance with Lera, or do you want to just go ahead and dance with Julianne?" I owed Julianne. She had just dropped everything, put off a recording session in Los Angeles to fly to New Jersey and dance with me. I felt like a complete asshole. I had promised Julianne. Was I going to let a simple little nip slip turn my head? That would be a dick move, and I knew it. Unaware of the drama going down on my end, Julianne's father called my father.
"Hey, this is Bruce Huff," he began crisply. "This partnership idea with your young son and my Julianne, I just want you to understand that I'm totally against it. I don't even know where Saddlebrook, New Jersey is. If she does end up coming out there, which I'm totally against, she has to stay with a Mormon family somewhere in the area. Good people who could introduce her at their temple." My dad was at a loss.
"What?
What? First of all, I don't even know whether Mormons exist here in New Jersey. I thought they were all confined to Utah." At that point in time, at pretty much any point in time, my dad had 100,000 things to worry about, beyond trying to track down a Mormon family in his immediate vicinity. "Blat," he said to himself and hung up the phone. What was good about Bruce's phone call, I realized when Pops told me about it, was that at least it gave us some sort of excuse for why a partnership with Julianne might not work out. Otherwise, we had nothing. Nothing. Nada. Julianne had just changed all her plans for this thing, and I felt terrible. We felt terrible. The Chmerkovsky, we, Max, Dad, Mom, and myself, we all felt ourselves in the wrong, and that just didn't feel right. I felt terrible, but I was that type of person. I had tunnel vision, and I could not help it. That's my normal MO. I obsess. I don't admire. I don't love. I obsess. When I wanted to dance with Julianne, she totally entered into my head. Then Lera came along and swept all those thoughts clean. All I could think about was the look and feelings that I had when I was dancing with her. That was it. I didn't care about anything else. I never wanted to second guess myself. I see what I see. I feel what I feel, and I go for what I want. I don't question it. We went home where my dad said, "Listen, you gotta make the call to Julianne." My brother said, "Just man up. It's not the end of the fucking world. Just talk to her." My mother chimed in, "Call her, Valya." In the meantime, Valeria was also under the gun herself. I heard a rumor that Shirley Ballas, the mother of Julianne's former partner, Mark, was pressuring Lera to come to England and try out with Derek, who was Shirley's student and like a son to her. Along with her husband Corky, Shirley was a major power in the ballroom world, the self-styled Queen of Latin. She and Corky had not only raised Mark and their whole family of other champions, but also mentored the Huffs, both Derek and Julianne. Shirley wanted Lera for Derek, and what Shirley wanted in ballroom, she usually got. Lera texted me, her words seeming to come out breathless from a lack of commas. "What is the prospect here because I need to figure out what I'm doing because I don't want to go to England. I want to dance with you, but I need to know this. Пожалуйста. Please." "Well, first, you didn't want to piss John Kimmins off," Max said, laughing off my predicament. "Now you're going to piss Shirley Ballas off. Good luck with your results next year, buddy." I felt like I was James Dean and Rebel Without a Cause. "You're tearing me apart." I was stuck. It was now Saturday night. I had just finished the semester at college, so we had plans to celebrate. My brother and I were in the car, heading out for the night, and he would not let up. "This is dumb. You'll have plenty of Saturday nights in your life. Meantime, Julianne's flying in Monday morning. You gotta get on the phone and tell her you're calling it off." "I can't," I said pathetically. "I just had a conversation with her about flying out here. And how, like, we were gonna put her up and take care of everything. I can't call her now and tell her, 'Hey, by the way, all that shit I promised you, none of that is happening because we're not dancing with you.'" I turned to Max with a big-eyed kid brother look that had worked with him when I was young. "Will you call her?" He exploded. "No, I can't fucking call her. It's your mess. You clean it up. Please, bro, will you, please? I really can't do it." "Shut up. Just make the call. You're seriously pissing me off." I sank back in the car seat. Okay, I'll call. But listen, let's pick up our boys first, okay?" As always, I need a backup to inject a little steel in my spine. We were on our way to collect Eugene and Andre at work, and when we got there, I left Max in the car while I went in to fetch the boys. I found them hanging out in the stairwell, the smell of marijuana strong and potent. "Want some?" Eugene asked, offering the joint to me. "Are you kidding?" I was stressed out and needed a break from reality. When we got back to Max, waiting in the car, he knew instantly we were all high as apple pie. "Bro, what the fuck?" he asked, clearly disgusted. "Listen," I babbled. "I'm in no position to call. You have to." I admit I was a coward about it. My brother was the one who ended up getting on the phone and breaking a girl's heart. "Hey, listen, Julianne," Max said smoothly. "We decided to go in a different direction and we're sorry and blah, blah, blah." I tuned his actual words out, unable to listen. Julianne was indeed upset, but what was there to be said? "Okay, cool," she sighed, practical and gracious as ever. Then, to be fair, I did end up speaking with her the next day, when my brain got unscrambled and I was able to apologize like a human being. Choosing Lera as a partner wound up being the biggest favor I could ever do for Julianne. Yes, she might have been heartbroken because of all of my foolishness. She never did return to ballroom competition, with me or with anyone else. But a short year later, a certain reality TV show about ballroom dancing came along, and with that, a young star was born named Julianne Hough. She ended up doing the show, released her amazing country music albums, and became a huge Hollywood star. If it hadn't been for a single little innocent nip-slip, who knows? Julianne and I might be married right now, or dancing and competing as partners. It's crazy how the world works. Sometimes the things that don't happen have the biggest impact on your life, not the things that do happen. I look back and marvel about Max and me and Julianne, Mark and Derek, the multiplying connections we all have, originally arising from the limited world of ballroom, but now magnified by the wide world of television. Our relationship stemmed from a series of small, mostly unknown episodes, but man, do we go way back. "It's a small world," said the comedian Stephen Wright, "but I wouldn't want to paint it." At the time, the whole business with Julianne and Lera was fairly unbearable, though in hindsight, it makes me laugh. I just hope all my future problems turn out so well for everyone. The Ukrainian Bachelor. I didn't go with them, but my brother and dad returned to Odessa in 2007, visiting the old hometown. It might have been a mistake. The city looked terrible, they reported. Its shit gone gray and dreary. My father and Max found the old estate house with the courtyard, and I think my dad might have shed a tear about how run down the place was, how there was little upkeep, how the building appeared to be somehow sinking back into the earth. As much as his heart still felt connected to Ukraine, my father saw the visit as a sad confirmation that he had done the right thing for his kids. Maybe we were all delusional about what our surroundings looked like when Max and I were little. Or maybe the old homestead struck my brother and father as shabby because of how we now lived in America, which had such a different environment and different style of energy. The separation between Ukraine and the States showed itself not merely in the physical things, but also in the mentality among the residents, a vibe in the air. This is not to say that our Ukrainian life was hard and our American life has been easy. No, our lives in the States had never been easy. But as poor as we were at first, at least moving to the States had turned out to be worth the discomfort. The lack of ease was justified. You gotta pay your dues to live in this amazing beauty of a country. Hard work is worthwhile because it pays off. In Ukraine, nothing paid off. Hard work was just hard work. In America, you could have goals and make progress. Everything seems possible. But back home, I still catch myself saying home for Ukraine when really I know in my heart that America is my home. There was this depressing, defeated attitude. What exactly am I paying my dues for? Oh, I remember now. I gotta pay my dues to get the hell out of this country. I returned to Ukraine only a few times in my adult life, but have never yet gone back to Odessa. If only because my grandfather was buried there, I know that at some point in the future I'll make my pilgrimage. It's as if I'm saving up the experience for when my days and ways quiet down, when I possess the emotional balance to make the trip meaningful. I had a near miss with my old hometown in 2009, when I spent some time in Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine, 300 miles to the north of Odessa. Typical for that period of my life, I was at a ballroom dance competition when the opportunity arose to go to Kyiv. And since the competition was being held in Moscow, I was at least in the same time zone. I got a call from my brother. "Hey, yo, can you do me a favor?" Max asked. The producers of the Ukrainian version of the hit reality show The Bachelor had contacted him, he said. Max's first impulse was to turn them down flat. "It's a crazy idea," he told me. "I don't think I want to do it." The producers heard that I was in Moscow and suggested I might act as my brother's scout in Kyiv. "Listen, they'll fly you down there," Max said. "Just meet with them, give me the overall scope of things, and tell me what you think." I was there for 2 days, during which the producers wined and dined me to within an inch of my life. If you've ever experienced Ukrainian hospitality and can recall the fog of toasts and banqueting, you know what I mean. My hosts were execs from the Esteban Network, which operated Ukraine's most popular commercial channel. They had licensed the rights to The Bachelor, the concept from Warner Brothers, creating what they called Holostyak, Russian for Bachelor. As soon as I arrived, I understood immediately what a big deal the show would be. For the time and place, the budget was huge, more than had been spent on any series previously. I could see that the entire network was behind the show, which had the potential of being a game changer in the limited world of Ukrainian television. I took meetings with execs who were all really jazzed about the project. They had brought in consultants from all over the world. They would devote the resources, they assured me, to make the program look sleek and professional. Then I visited the TV studio where the show would be shot. I remember my conversation with Max from that day. "Hey, bro," I started out, giving him our traditional greeting. "You know when the kids pretend to be an astronaut and they use a cardboard box for a spaceship?" "Yeah?" he asked, wondering what I was getting at. "Well, the soundstage where Dancing with the Stars is shot, that's like fucking NASA. This place in Kyiv, the TV studio here is like the cardboard box." The infrastructure wasn't even worthy of being in the same conversation. It was so poor. But I noticed something else, too, on that visit. All the executive producers at the network were young, in their mid-20s, but when they opened their mouths, they sounded as if they were 80 years old. I met a few of the girls they were considering casting on the show, and they came off as mature beyond their years, too. A young woman would speak to me in Russian, and even if I didn't follow everything that she was saying, I could see the depth in her eyes and detect the wisdom in her words. It felt crazy to me, because obviously they were young, but it helped me to understand that people grew up fast in Eastern Europe. This was before civil war kicked the stuffing out of much of the country, but in some ways, even back then, Ukraine felt as though it had slipped down from second world status to borderline third. I noticed that billboards featured not celebrities, but rather large pictures of ugly politicians. On the other hand, big American stars like George Clooney were featured all the time, doing product endorsements on TV commercials, translated into Russian. Seeing George do it gave me an idea, providing the logic for encouraging Max to participate in the Ukrainian Bachelor. "Listen, you'll be a superstar here," I told my brother. "Unlike Clooney, you could speak Russian, and they don't even have to translate you. We're talking about a financial opportunity and an opportunity to increase your visibility in a whole different market," I said. "Yes, we really do talk like that to each other occasionally. It's far enough from America that no one back there will give a fuck if it's a fail. And even if it turns out not to be the best look for you, you're still appearing on far and away the biggest TV show in the country." Max didn't even have to say anything for me to summon up the cynical expression that was probably crossing his face at the moment. I shifted my argument into overdrive. "You're handsome as fuck. You are the Bachelor, dude. What better storyline could there be? Here comes a son of the great Ukrainian nation who went to America and found fortune and fame but couldn't find love. Now the only love that he wants, the someone he dreams and yearns for, is a Ukrainian princess. He wants to make her his international queen. Talk about a fairy tale. How could anyone say no to that? In the end, I convinced him. He did the show and blew up as big as it was humanly possible to blow big in Ukraine. A humongous star. Prince Charming, a local boy made good. The show did smashingly well too. At one point managing the feat of beating out a broadcast of Euro Cup game, Ukraine versus France. The first time any Ukrainian show had received higher ratings than soccer. A couple of times, I flew out to see Max on the set of Ukrainian Bachelor. My first impression was that he spoke Russian much better than me. My mind was blown, seeing him with the lineup of 25 Eastern European women. They appeared to me to be some hard women, ready to eat my poor brother alive. I didn't think I would have liked to meet any of them in a dark alley, much less the whole platoon. All I could do was mentally wish him the best of luck. The Holostyak producers seemed to be willing to spend money, and the show filmed all over the world, in the Canary Islands, in Paris, and in Italy. There were scenes with Max arriving to pick up a girl for a date in a vintage 1956 Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud. My brother had plenty of insecurities about women, but he also possessed a simplicity and honesty on the direct opposite end of that romantic spectrum, from the fake figure presented by The Bachelor, which practically shouts, douchebag. Hey, I want to find love on television as millions of people watch. Let me go on TV and pick the love of my life from a group of 25 women, and let's all pretend that this whole business is the most natural thing in the world. Plus, Max was selling the concept to a totally flat-footed society. America loves The Bachelor, because most people get the joke. The U.S. audience watches to get away from everyday woes and laugh and smile and not take things too seriously. Eastern Europeans know how to take things just one way, and that's extremely seriously. They're the people at the party who don't get the joke. Max won over maybe 80% of the audience, with the other 20% hating him out of pure spite. The show painted my brother as a super successful entrepreneur and celebrity superstar from America, rolling up to luxury venues and luxury cars. You think Hollywood is the land of make-believe, but this was a whole different kind of fairy tale. Max looked good in the role of the young prince, which not everybody in the world can pull off. Flying in on a private jet, stepping out onto the tarmac, you try that sometime and see if you could manage not to look like an ass. At the same time, Max put across his essentially humble nature, emphasizing total respect for the women involved. Success matched with humility was a killer combination, wholly novel in Ukraine, where financial security was unfortunately synonymous with a certain attitude of entitlement. Fuck everybody. You know who I am? Out of my way. I got money. In the United States, there can be similar attitude, but it's never as flagrant as it is in Eastern Europe. Max was something new under the Ukrainian sun, a rich kid, at least on TV, who was also approachable, respectful, and not a total asshole. The combination made him a star among men and women both, until the finale. Then Max's choice came down to two girls. One was like a version of Miss Ukraine, super beautiful, charming, and gushingly in love, to the point of being borderline embarrassing when expressing her emotions for him. The second finalist was a much chillier bitch, a little thinner, a little hotter, a little more put together. The options were laid out clearly, the Western-style city chick versus the all-Ukrainian girl. It wasn't a reality TV show anymore. Holostyak had become a test of the national character. Max went with Sasha, the city chick, and the country immediately exploded. You cannot imagine the extremity of the reaction. Max gave me the numbers, which I don't know if I can believe. Out of a population of like 45 million, 23 million watched the show, with the remaining 22 million not connected to electricity. On Google's trending topics in Ukraine, Holostyak ranked number one. It mattered to folks. This was in the aftermath of the 2004-2005 Orange Revolution in the country, where confrontation loomed between Ukraine and Mother Russia. But forget about all that boring political stuff. Let's talk about Max and Sasha. People were hugely invested in the results and reacted to the outcome with rage in their minds and spittle on their lips. What a fucking piece of shit that Maxim Shmerkovsky is. What an idiot. Sasha's gonna play him. Doesn't he see that? According to the concept of The Bachelor, Sasha was the supposed love of Max's life. She lasted with my brother for all of 2 days. He called me with his report. We landed at LAX, and she wasn't interested in her surroundings at all. Never asked me to help her get a job or figure out how she was going to make her way in Los Angeles. She was like, hey, I want to get a pair of shoes I really like. Can I get your credit card? Of course, like a softie, I gave my credit card and pointed her to Rodeo Drive. But I didn't think that should have been the first thing coming out of her mouth, you know? So the relationship came to an abrupt end. In the aftermath, Max revealed his strategy to me, which was actually pretty smart. Look, I knew that any relationship that began on The Bachelor probably wouldn't last for me. I figured it would be a lot easier for the public over there to buy the fact that me and this girl Sasha didn't work out. They would expect that. But the public would go berserk if me and Miss Ukraine didn't get married and lived happily ever after. The logic made sense to me. For once, my brother had an actual logical point. Take the loss now, position himself to win later. Season 12 of Dancing with the Stars aired live in the States just as Holestyak was being broadcast on STB in Ukraine. Max killed it on Dancing with the Stars that season, pairing with actress Kirstie Alley and finishing as runner-up, his best showing up until that point. The show peaked, too, with one episode watched by over 30 million people, a record. As a kind of anti-climax, my superstar brother was required by contract to return to Kiev and make an appearance on a last follow-up episode of Holestyak. You want to come with me? He asked. It was characteristic of the Shmerkovsky brothers to enlist backup when entering dicey situations. Plus, I still owed him for having my back during the Julianne disaster. We flew into Kiev to be met with the biggest media clusterfuck I've ever encountered. I couldn't believe it. We collected our baggage, stepped out of the airport door, and ran into a solid wall of cameras. Later on, I would enjoy my fair share of celebrity and experienced emerging from a theater, say, to find tons of screaming fans greeting me. This was on a whole different level, though. This was David Beckham meets Barack Obama meets the resurrection of the living Elvis. The Bachelor returns, to be greeted by utter pandemonium. When it came to fashion, swagger, and demeanor, Max and I were the real American deal. Ukraine had seen modern American style before, of course, but mostly secondhand on television. And the country had also seen its share of Russian style, which was sort of a bootleg American vibe crossed with vodka-infused tackiness. What Ukraine hadn't seen was us. In Max, the country saw the epitome of cool, someone they could idolize. Without too much patting ourselves on the back, I have to say we came off as from Brooklyn, successfully assimilated and authentically American all the way. My brother did the follow-up show and had me come on as a guest. The shooting day stretched to 12 hours filming in an unair-conditioned room somewhere in the Ukrainian boondocks with no union rules and no lunch breaks. It was already evening when we finally finished up just in time to hit the after party. My brother and I and one of the Holestyak producers rode to the nightclub and climbed out of the limo. Immediately, we were gang-rushed by a horde of female fans. I remember the moment well, with them tottering toward us in stiletto heels, managing to look silly and dangerous at the same time. Oh my God, oh my God, they called out. Can we have a picture? People started to pour out from the front doors of the club. In an instant, the scene spiraled out of control. One of the female fans wrapped herself around my brother, something like a tongue around a lollipop. In the background, I saw a big dude rumble forward, summoned from inside by the bouncers. It turned out to be the tongue's boyfriend. As if it were going down in cinematic slow motion, I witnessed the confrontation happen. The boyfriend steamed up to Max, said, "I know you," in Russian, then boom, punched my brother in the face. I reacted on pure impulse. Before I could think, bam! I slugged the dude with a right hook